Welcome to episode 17 of the Scadi podcast. This episode is the first of a trilogy of episodes of the topic of rogue trading within the wholesale financial markets. Many of Scadi's financial experts have witnessed and experienced the devastating effects of a trader gone rogue. In this trilogy, we hope to share the personal accounts of our experts and what it's like to deal with these unprecedented events. In this episode, we start with the collapse of Baring Securities, sharing experiences of being part of a business in administration and how this process may look different in today's industry. We hope you enjoy.
So Nick and Martin, you are both working at Baring's the time that this big collapse happened, and then you both went in the transition to ING. So tell us a bit about what that was like, what kind of things were going on in the offices at Baring's Bank, or I suppose it was the weekend.
It was the weekend. It was a very eventful weekend. I distinctly remember on the Friday going into that weekend, and this is back in 1995, just around about the time of the annual bonus. Everyone was getting very excited and thinking about the year that had just passed and, you know, how well they were going to do or not. And I remember bumping into somebody in the lift on the Friday who happened, this is first thing in the morning, said, oh, did you hear about the problems in Asia overnight with that missed margin call? And I kind of said, yeah, terrible, or something like that. I had no clue what was going on, but I carried on with the day. And then that weekend, I remember going back, getting the weekend papers to have a look through, see if there was any news around, and nothing was there on the Saturday, and got the papers on the Sunday and flipped straight to the business section to try and find any details about this missed margin call. And I remember my wife was poking me in the side of my arm and flipping over the front page and saying, look at this, Baring's is bust. And that was the first real inkling I had that, wow, something big had happened.
So that was Scadi's director, Martin Anthony, sharing his experience of the day it all went wrong at Baring's. Baring's Bank was up until that point the oldest merchant bank in Britain, until it abruptly collapsed in February of 1995. Further along the second floor, Scadi's managing director, Nick Corrie, was just starting out his career in finance. He came to Baring's as a quantitative analyst working in the Baring Emerging Market Index, completely unaware of the horror that was about to befall the company that he was working at.
Well, you know, that's exactly right. That's as I remember it happening. It was that quick, and it certainly was, you know, that time of year. But I do remember that we all headed into the office. Because what else could you do?
Yeah.
And I, you know, for me, for my perception, there were far more people in the office on that Sunday than I'd ever seen at any time before. And you know, we didn't have work from home in those days.
Well, this is the time of the rumours of the Bank of England rescue plan swirling around, and everybody wanted to be there on the ground. You know, when this meeting finally closed at 10 o'clock, 11 o'clock on a Sunday night, whatever it was going to be, no one really knew.
Well, you remember, Martin, there were two distinct offices. There was the Baring Brothers over at number 8 Bishopsgate, yep, which was a kind of car drive away from the Bank of England. And then you had number 1 America Square at the Baring Securities, that's where we were, which was really down the other end of the city, really, the other side of the insurance area, if you like, down near the Tower of London. And you did get, sort of messages coming back saying, you know, that the lifeboat's yeah, in place, or the lifeboat's looking dicey, or whatever it happens to be. And I do remember when those directors came back to America Square, one of them, and I'm not going to name them, but I remember them running onto the dealing floor going, it's all gone wrong, it's all gone. And it just created pandemonium and panic.
Yeah, yeah.
And there were sort of mad scenes as people sort of tried to grab things. And
anything, computers, staplers, pencils, rulers, I don't know what was going flying out the door, but people just wanted to just grab anything they could and run out of the building.
But I do remember then that Mr. Katz, Richard Katz, came in, who was the head of trade. He was a kind of brash, cigar-smoking, really kind of tough trader. And he just sort of came in and just went, "Now, everybody settle down. We're all going to come back tomorrow and we're going to work through this." And it calmed everything right down. We came back. And then that was an interesting experience, because we were a business in administration, weren't we? Yeah. So I think the first meeting we had in the morning was with I remember someone coming in from the administrators. I can't remember who the administrators were, actually. It would be a matter of record. Mm. I mean, we could look that up. But that was interesting, because there were just sort of simple things that you took for granted, like whether there would be loo roll. And you know what? By the middle of the morning, it had all gone. And it wasn't replenished. So it's sort of fundamental things like that. But also just that you couldn't do anything, because no one would transact with us. So everyone was sat there. Of course, you had to pass the time. And that's how everyone got very good at the game of Doom. Do you remember Doom?
The video game at the time, yeah, Doom.
Yeah, so people were doing a lot of that, playing a lot of that. But then...
And I think making markets with each other about pretty much anything, the time that the desk head's jacket would appear on the chair in the morning, it's a nice two-way market, the spreads for lunch hour, arrival and departure, just betting on anything, because all... the licenses were suspended. We couldn't trade in the markets or with any counterparties at all. So, we had to fill the time somehow.
Yeah, but it was also it was that lack of information too.
Yeah, yeah.
Because we weren't really in that information era, where you had, the internet was in its infancy. So there wasn't this kind of constant scrolling media and access to information. There wasn't Twitter and all this kind of stuff. So you really were hungry for information. And I do remember Michael Baring, who's one of the Baring brothers, mm-hmm. or cousins, he started coming down to the dealing floor, getting a microphone, standing on a desk, and giving people an informational update, which was very valuable as to what was happening. And then in between all of that, there were rumours about who was looking at the business and whether they were looking at all of it, whether they were looking at some of it. And after a period of time, this bank called Ing, as we called them, turned up. We weren't called Ing at all, they were ING. But we really, I'd never heard of them. I'd seen them they advertised on the top of the FT every day as the Emerging Markets Bank, which actually was a pretty good fit for us, because we were really, definitely the Emerging Markets Broker. That's what Baring's business was. And they bought Baring's for £1, and rescued us. And that was they were a very, very different organisation to how we'd been before. And in fact, for a business like Baring's that was trying to have pretensions in derivatives and structured products, what you needed was a parent with really strong credit, really good credit rating, because that meant that you were able to offer customers really competitive trades, because a lot of the success in derivatives is about financing levels, and that provided really good access to financing. But of course, for a bank that had blown itself up through misuse of derivatives, to get a derivatives license was very, very hard once ING took over. And I knew a lot of that firsthand, because I went to work in ING Baring Financial Products, which was a great place to work and very, very interesting, seeing how a business like that had to jump through the hoops with the Securities and Futures Authority, as was, to try and get that business up and running.
So yes, as the story goes, after a failed bailout attempt for Baring's Bank, it was eventually bought by IMG for the massive sum of £1. And the rest is history. Now, this podcast is the first of three episodes to talk about the topic of rogue trading, with the three main cases being Nick Leeson of Baring's, Jerome Kerviel of SocGen, and Kwaku Adeboli of UBS. As you've been hearing up until now, to help with my research for this podcast trilogy, I wanted to hear the personal accounts of those who had experienced these detrimental incidents of rogue trading. Later on, we will then dive into exactly how and why these rogue trading cases happened. As you may have guessed, the collapse of Barings Bank didn't happen on its own. The main contributor to this collapse was the rogue trading activities of a man called Nick Leeson. Leeson was a trader at Barings who managed to congregate huge losses unseen by the middle and back offices. He made use of error accounts and manipulation tactics in order to hide his losses from management. Now, whether you're a seasoned trader or a compliance professional, rogue trading can take a lot of different shapes and forms. So let's start at the very bottom and ask the financial experts at Skadi what rogue trading is in its most basic form.
My first question is, what is rogue trading?
Well, to me, rogue trading is clearly unauthorized trading. It could be a breach of a limit. It could be concealing trades. It could be using systems and technology to conceal your activities from your line managers, your head of desk, risk and control functions, that kind of thing. But to me, it's a clear intent to conceal your activity from the management of the firm.
I think that's exactly right. It's all about concealment. It's about concealing your risk position, the risk you're taking, and the profit, or more likely losses, that you're making. Although people do hide profits as well. And when you look back at the instances of rogue trading, more often than not, they lead to catastrophic consequences that can lead to, you know, or certainly risk the whole firm and whether it will be able to transact. And that's whether that's in, you know, the high profile big instances, or indeed some of the really small rogue trading circumstances or events that have happened.
I think it's anything to kind of manipulate your what the kind of outward perception of what your activity is doing. So if you look in the case of say Kerviel, Jerome Kerviel, for example, he actually fictitiously made losing trades to kind of give the appearance that he was not making as much profit as he was had on his books when he was making unauthorized trades. This was to kind of hide from management what he was doing. So even anything like that, it's just manipulating the appearance of your trading activities so that management, or, you know, operations, whoever it is getting the wrong idea. So there's a few takes on what rogue trading is in its most basic form. So in the case of Leeson, where did it all begin? Well, for Leeson, his desk was actually an arbitrage desk. Now, we'll learn a bit more about arbitrage in a second from some of the experts at Skadi, but in a nutshell, it's a trading strategy that assumes a virtually no risk for very small return. But as you can imagine, repeat this many times with a high amount of money, then it will certainly pay off. With that in mind, let's take a look at how this relatively low-risk strategy turned into a huge loss-making venture in the case of Leeson.
So, moving to my second question, what is arbitrage?
So, arbitrage is the practice of buying one thing in one jurisdiction or on one exchange and then selling a similar, or quite often exactly the same, product on another one. So, and what you're looking to do is buy something and then sell it for a very small profit, and you just do that again and again, and over time, obviously, if it can be a profitable arbitrage strategy, you'll make money from a lot of very small trades over a long period of time.
And this could be dual listed stocks, this could be convertible bonds, this could be American depository receipts. There's a whole host of different instruments that we can find arbitrage to be used in trading strategies.
And I think in institutions, because as DT said, the difference you're trying to make is very small. Institutions generally, the major ones, would be taking over time large positions to capitalize on the very small differences that they can capture with the arbitrage. So it's not unusual for there to be big positions built up over time, which, you know, are normally traded off against each other for a very small profit.
Yeah, but I think the key thing, Alexandra, is that it's really difficult to find these kind of opportunities in the marketplace. And where they do exist, they exist for tiny amounts of time, unless there's something structurally that means that it's not possible to close the arbitrage. So there may be a lack of borrow in one market, so you can affect the purchase, but you can't affect the opposing sale to close off the arbitrage. So it's all about making risk-free profit, and the more closely aligned the securities are, the less risky it is. And so people do describe some strategies as arbitrage, but really they're quite risky because they involve undertaking trades which don't happen at the same time, which don't involve the same instrument. But if you look back at Leeson, who was famously named the turbo arbitrager by his boss, Ron Baker, he was the turbo arbitrager. He was transacting in two different contracts, and it was believable to everyone on the outside that these arbitrage opportunities could exist because one of the contracts was traded on exchange and the other contract was traded in an open outcry pit. And I think, Martin, also the two contracts were in different currencies, weren't they? I seem to remember that Osaka was traded in yen, but I have a feeling that Cymex was traded in another currency. But I might have to look into that just to confirm.
Yeah, yeah.
But certainly there was enough scope for it to be possible for there to be these pricing differences between the two exchanges. And certainly Leeson pushed that narrative very, very hard to his management. And because he was making plenty of money, nobody scrutinized really what he was doing. They just accepted what he said.
I mean, when you look at the three cases of that we've kind of put out in this podcast of rogue trading, the numbers that they're dealing with are huge numbers. But actually kind of looking at, you know, arbitrage, as you were saying, Martin, is very low risk. You're going to be dealing with huge amount of huge positions. So the kind of numbers that are going through the books, it's probably understandable that you know, institutions might let slip a few of these kind of unauthorized trades because of just purely because of the amount of volume of how much is going through them.
Yeah, I think you're right, and I think from the institution's point of view, if they, you know, ran with the story that you are essentially hedged and just looking to make very small P&Ls of these positions, yes, you know, and they keep getting daily P&L reports and monthly P&L reports that look very encouraging. Yes, you could understand that they may look in at other desks first. They may look at, you know, high risk or perceived high risk operations and leave the arbitrage desk alone, because from their point of view, if they believe what they're being told, they're fully hedged, there's minimal risk, we're just taking very small profits trade by trade.
And operationally, to give us an idea of the economy of scale, I've worked in teams that are responsible purely for arbitrage, for converting one product to another, convertible bonds, ADRs, whatever the case may be, for trading desks and for hedge funds. That's easily a team of 3 to 4 to 5 people. So that really demonstrates the scale that we're talking about here.
So as we covered there, the kinds of trading activities that Leeson himself was involved in often used very large numbers in their day-to-day dealings. So what was the size of the actual damage that he caused? Well, in the end, the total losses surmounted just over $1.4 billion, which, in today's currency, that would be worth about $2.8 billion. It's almost impossible to imagine that this obscene amount of money could be hidden somewhere amongst the books in a bank. However, Leeson was a crafty fella. He actually came from the back office himself, so he already had a strong knowledge of the ins and outs of how they operated at Barings. When he began trading for Barings, he started to realise there were certain ways he could hide his huge losses within the systems at Barings through the use of error accounts. Let's now take a deeper look into error accounts and how exactly Leeson was able to use them to his advantage.
Okay, so following with my next question. So what are the error accounts and how Nick Leeson was using error accounts?
I mean, it's basically errors occur on a trading floor, on a trading desk, and they need to be accounted for. But also, everywhere I've worked, there's been different levels of sign-off depending on how serious the error is. So if it's a very small error, then it can be signed off by the desk head. But increasingly, as the size of the error increases, then it needs a higher level sign-off to
be reported.
So that the management are aware of what's occurred. And certainly it's important to have a paper trail covering errors, because it is a route for people to conduct unauthorised trading if it's not correctly monitored.
Yeah, certainly where I've worked, even on a small error, as in a sort of $10 error, we would fill in a ticket just because it meant that there was a record of it, so that someone could go back and account for it properly. It was just, certainly wherever I've worked, they've been very keen that was exactly how it should go.
And I think in Nick's case, in Leeson's case, I think, as we discussed, it was used very much if one of his traders made even a small error at the start, he could book it into this account, take some time to evaluate what's going on and maybe clear the position, and then take away from the error account. And I think as we've touched on, it should all be part of a big reconciliation that's carried out within the bank to say, yes, you've got all these customer accounts trading, you've got all these brokerage accounts that you have to settle and pay margin to, and then the error account is included in that overall reconciliation. I think from what we hear, I mean, at the start, Leeson put some trades on then was fully expecting the call from London to say, oh, what's all this going on in this error account? I think when that didn't happen, he managed to do some clever accounting tricks with the system and conceal his activity. Once he realised that it wasn't really being factored in or included in any reconciliation of how much yen they had to pay, then he realised he could just keep parking trades there without really being too worried about being found out.
Yeah, it came about, the he set up the error account because the margin calculation on the Cymex exchange was, there was a new software release, and we're going back to 1995 now, and earlier in fact, and that had a really negative impact on Barings' own internal systems. It was released, and immediately there was problems at Barings in their back office. So there was an instruction that came from Barings in London to switch off the reporting of trades from Cymex because it was causing these problems.
Yeah.
And so it wasn't really that Leeson kind of hid this account. He kind of got tipped off by the activity of and instructions from Barings in London that he could set up an account like this and he could suppress the reporting of it. And no one would question it. And again, he got another legitimate cover, rather like his arbitrage, in that he could explain it away by saying, "Well, I had to set this up to prevent positions getting reported back, which would mess things up because of the new Cymex margin calculation." So that really gave him his opportunity to set up the error account. And indeed, every time there was a loss-making trade, into the error account they went, and he was running huge positions and huge losses over, you know, long periods of time, undiscovered. But as we'll probably hear later, he got other problems that came with having large positions running for a long period of time in futures.
But doesn't it all come down to the nub of the issue, which was he was a trader, but he also had access to be able to get hold of the back office books and actually do the settlement as well as the trading. So obviously that has since changed in every other institution, whereby those roles are definitively split.
That's exactly right. He had operational know-how, and that really helped him.
Indeed, a large part of Leeson's success was due to his ability to operate on both sides of the balance sheet without being caught. And Leeson had access to the operations side of his trading books, meaning he had full control over what his trading activities would look like for anyone else looking at those books. So that was part one of the Rogue Trading Chronicles, where we've been discussing the activities of Nick Leeson in relation to the collapse of Barings Bank. Join us later for part two, where we discuss the repercussions of this specific case before diving into the other two large rogue trading cases, that of Jerome Kerviel at SocGen and Kwaku Adeboli of UBS. Join with me today in discussion was Nick Corrie, Damian Taylor, Martin Anthony and David Bridges, with research and interviews carried out by myself, Coleman Corrie, and Alexandra Mexi. If you want to listen to any more episodes, just find us by searching the Scardi podcast on any streaming platform, and feel free to connect to us at Scardi Limited on LinkedIn. And there you can read about our research and business relating to anti-financial crime and control functions. Thank you very much for listening.